President Obama has said he wants to send a clear message to President Assad that any use of chemical weapons in Syria is unacceptable. Mr. Obama has been meeting congressional leaders to try to rally support for military action ahead of a vote on the issue next week. A short time ago, the leader of the Republicans in the House of Representatives said he backed the plans for a limited strike, as Johnny Diamond reports from Washington.
Support from John Boehner is a big boost for President Obama. If the Republican House leader had come out against the president's request, it might well have been doomed. Mr. Boehner does not, however, exert tight control over his colleagues. Many have rebelled before on important issues. So President Obama has taken time this morning to explain again why he feels intervention is necessary. And he has reiterated that any action would, in his words, be limited and proportional. This is not, he said, Iraq or Afghanistan. There will be no boots on the ground.
Earlier, Israel and the United States conducted a joint test of Israel's missile defence system over the Mediterranean Sea. Here, David Cameron pledged that the UK would lead the world in ensuring humanitarian aid got through to refugees driven from their homes by the Syrian conflict. The UN says 7 million people have been affected, calling Syria the great tragedy of this century.
This is a limited, proportional step. It will send a clear message not only to the Assad regime, but also to other countries that may be interested in testing some of these international norms, that there are consequences. It gives us the ability to degrade Assad's capabilities when it comes to chemical weapons. It also fits into a broader strategy that we have to make sure that we can bring about over time the kind of strengthening of the opposition and the diplomatic and economic and political pressure required so that ultimately we have a transition that can bring peace and stability not only to Syria but to the region.
Immediately after the meeting, there was good news for the president. John Boehner leads the Republicans in the House of Representatives, the body perhaps most likely to vote down the president's plans. Mr. Boehner said he would support the proposed military action.
The United States, for our entire history, has stood up for democracy and freedom for people around the world. The use of these weapons has to be responded to, and only the United States has the capability and the capacity to stop Assad and to warn others around the world that this type of behavior is not going to be tolerated.
President Obama also needs support from congressional Democrats. He got a vote of confidence from Nancy Pelosi, the leader of Democrats in the House of Representatives.
President Obama did not draw the red line. Humanity drew it. Decades ago, 170-some countries supporting the Convention on not using chemical warfare. So it is really something that, from a humanitarian standpoint, cannot be ignored, or else we cannot say never again. Secondly, from a national security standpoint, we have to send a very clear message to those who have weapons of mass destruction of any variety that they should forget about using them.
The problem for President Obama is that neither John Boehner nor Nancy Pelosi control their troops. There is dissent in the ranks. A long week of lobbying and arm twisting awaits.
We woke this morning to the news from the United Nations that more than 2 million Syrians are now registered as refugees. I've been hearing from one of them, Mahmoud Moussa, a man who did hold down a respectable job in Syria. He was a head teacher, living with his family in a village near the northern city of Aleppo, his family being his wife and three children aged 13, 8 and 5. Now, he and his extended family, about 20 of them, are living at a camp in Turkey. He told me about how his old life ended.
The army, they took my village around the 18th of June 2011. So we were on the border for 10 days. Then we decided to escape to Turkey when there was no other choice.
And when you say escape to Turkey, how many people in your family made that journey?
We were my family, my mother, my brother and his family. We were, and some of my cousins, we were around about, can say, 20 people. Later on, after a month, my son, my brother also escaped and his family The first camp was called Reyhanlı. It was in next to Antakya in the southwest of Turkey. It was tents. The life was difficult at that time because it was summer, and we didn't use to live such circumstances. It was difficult for us, for the women especially, and for the kids. It was too dirty, too sunny, too hot.
What sort of accommodation did you have?
We had just a tent, some blankets, some beds. The water was very far. The toilets were very far. It was not easy to have a shower. There are just few trees, so there was no shadow. The tents were very, very hot inside.
How were the children?
The children suffered a lot. Of course, we didn't have electricity at that time, so the kids slept early and they got up early also. So we arranged for this and we didn't use to this. So we suffered all the day.
Now, you were in the camp for quite a long time. You talked about the hot summer. You were there for winter too.
Yes. At the beginning of winter in 2011, after the summer, it was very, very difficult for us because of, you know, cold weather and because of rain. Of course, it was not the problem of rain, raining from above us, but problem of the water coming in and under the tents. So we got up, we were wet because of the water under us. It was very difficult. And for my family, we suffered something else. My wife was sick. She had a back ache. She was not able to move, and it was very cold. And of course, she had that problem because of washing and taking care of the kids.
So being in the camp was making her ill.
Yes. And of course, I wasn't busy with my friends arranging for the people inside the camp. So I was busy with the camp with other people. My wife was busy with the tent and her kids.
And at any point, Mahmoud, did you think you'd done the wrong thing? Did you regret leaving Syria?
At all. I'm happy. I rebelled against the regime. My family are happy. I'm telling you the truth. Nobody regret that we rebelled against the regime, because if you didn't see what the regime did with the people, okay, we know how the regime dealt with the people. I'm in Kilis camp in Turkey, north of Aleppo. I am here. The only thing that I want is to go back to my country, nothing else.
What do you think the outside world should do?
I think they have to stay aside. I think they have to, because they didn't do anything for the civilian people, so I think they have to be apart.
Mahmoud Mosa with his extended family at a camp in Turkey. Listening to all that from Washington, D.C., Elizabeth Ferris, a senior fellow at the Brookings Institute and an analyst of internal displacement, and you have seen for yourself camps in Jordan and Lebanon. What did you witness?
What we saw was a tremendous number of people arriving very quickly in a very dynamic movement. The kind of stories that Mahmoud just told were common throughout the region, people who want to go home as soon as they can, but unfortunately prospects seem very dim for that.
How do other countries cope when large numbers turn up and keep turning up?
Well, I think the simple answer is they cope very badly. It's a tremendous burden to have that many people arrive so quickly. You know, a country like Lebanon, with a population of just over 4 million, has more than 700,000 registered refugees on top of perhaps another 500,000 Syrians who've been in the country for some time. So, you know, your infrastructure is stressed. Demands on education and on health care systems and on roads and on jobs are tremendous. I think the international community owes a tremendous debt to those countries who have kept their borders open.
And do these countries, on a practical level, how do they pay for all of that? Simply from their reserves, from their taxes?
Well, indeed, they pay a lot of the funds come from their own domestic resources, but also there is international support, and the UN has issued a tremendous appeal, something like $5 billion, to support humanitarian work inside Syria and the neighboring countries. But unfortunately, that's less than half funded.
We talk a lot about camps, and that's where Mahmoud was, and you've visited camps, as you say. But many refugees end up in towns and cities, becoming part of the community, where, as you suggest, they do become a strain on the infrastructure.
Certainly most of the refugees in the region are living outside of camps, on the margins of large cities or in informal settlements, or sometimes living with friends and relatives for extended periods of time. You know, it's not only that they pose more of a burden to the communities, but also that they're less visible. You know, when you think of refugees, you think of people congregated in a camp. But when they're dispersed throughout communities and living in six-floor walk-ups and apartment buildings, they simply aren't as visible and don't engender the same kind of political support as perhaps they do in camps.
What do people make of the incomers?
Host communities, initially very welcoming, still a lot of solidarity and hospitality on the part of people in the region. I think it's important to affirm that. But the longer they stay, the more likely that welcome grows thin as the demands on households and communities increase.
It's hard to imagine so many people on the move at the same time.
Indeed, you know, the scale of displacement is almost unprecedented. You know, it's happened so quickly and the movements are so dynamic. You know, people may go and stay with a relative and that doesn't work out and they move on. I remember a representative of the Jordanian Foreign Ministry telling us that Jordan was stop number four for Syrians, that Syrians had normally been displaced three times inside Syria before they made it across the border. And indeed, the plight of those displaced within the country, perhaps 5 million people, is serious indeed.
Just finally, I know this isn't why we asked you on, and you don't have to answer if you don't want to. I'm just intrigued, since you're in Washington, we've been hearing today from many of your senior politicians, there does seem to be a head of steam building up behind some kind of attack on Syria. Do you have a view on that?
Yes, indeed. I mean, I think that it probably will take place and certainly may be an important step in enforcing a norm against chemical weapons. But what it will mean for civilians on the ground, I think, is up in the air. Could it produce even further refugee movements? But this kind of military intervention is not designed to protect those people who are fleeing for their lives, as you just interviewed, Mahmoud.
Thank you. Elizabeth Ferris, Senior Fellow at the Brookings Institute and Analyst of Internal Displacement.